Welcome to the Idea Pod, a podcast dedicated to exploring and interrogating professional, biomedical, and applied ethics here at the University of Leeds.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Idea Pod. My name's Graeme Bex-Priestley, and I'm here with Christian Herzog. Hi, Christian.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
Christian, yeah, it's good to have you here. So for our audience, what do you do?
I'm originally an engineer by trade. I did my PhD in control theory. I did all the math, so very, very basic research, I would say. And while I did this, I started this in 2011, I also did engage in some teaching about the sustainability issues in engineering. So I kind of always, besides my engineering training and my research there, I was stuck with the broader topics. And today I would call it ethical questions. At that day we called it sustainability, but that of course could be included there. And when I started my postdoc, switched universities, I kind of missed this engagement. I had interesting research topics as well, but I wanted to pursue this further. And so it happens that actually now I've almost made a career shift, 180 degrees, but that's really not how I want to see this. I want to see this as a kind of, I want to combine both worlds. So when I decided to start studying applied and professional ethics at Leeds, I was really looking forward to starting my own research group, which I did now. I started it in January 2020, and really focusing on the ethical aspects of innovative technologies, mainly artificial intelligence or AI technology right now, using my expertise in engineering and computer science and control theory. As kind of a benefit in when I talk about ethical things, that I don't get the technology wrong, or maybe even can really combine the two perspectives. So that's what I do. My research group is called Ethical Innovation Hub, which also kind of says it all, that we really want engineering and technology people to connect with humanities and do this in a productive way for the products that they're trying to bring to the market even.
Oh. Where's this based?
That's based in Lübeck, I did my PhD in Hamburg, in Northern Germany.
And of course, everything's online anyway, right? So people come in to the hub from all over, right? Excellent.
Yeah.
Good. So you, like you said, you came to study here at the University of Leeds recently to do an MA in Applied and Professional Ethics. And you recently got two publications from some of the work you did here. Do you want to say anything about those two?
Yeah, actually, I think those two publications or the thesis I wrote, they're kind of linked with each other. So it started with the ethics project, where I was discussing whether we should or should not build artificial moral agents, so use machine ethics to design tools that kind of are capable of doing an ethical evaluation on their own. And I was, at that part, I was also intrigued about the discussions that were ongoing already, but I somehow felt that all the discussions, they kind of always targeted what will be in the end. So if we have something like this, will it be ethical? Will it be beneficial? And I was feeling that they were sometimes jumping a little bit too far, and I realized, or I thought it would be worthwhile to pursue the idea, okay, how would we actually get there, and see the ethics and the ethical challenges in there. And of course, this kind of mixes in a lot of things, I think, political theory and also economics, which honestly I don't know too much about, but I think I know enough about this to at least raise a warning that I think if we pursue this without, if we hasten this development and implement this into the capitalist system, if you will, then the actual promised goals of machine ethics actually promoting and furthering human morality, they might be undermined in some way. That was the first publication about, and I think I kind of continued this idea, not so much looking at the product, the artificial moral agent, but looking more at the tool that is behind this so formal ethics. And yeah, I was always looking for a new idea, and actually looking for something that would be worthwhile to publish, and I felt that I could try and go with this.
That's really interesting. So what was the origin of the idea to the dissertation topic?
So the dissertation topic I thought about when I already did my ethics project, and I attended a presentation at my local university here in Lübeck by an AI specialist that one of the institutes invited. And it was a broad bird's eye perspective talk, if you will. So my criticism at first might not do it proper justice, but I kind of felt that the one who was talking there, he felt very secure in a computer scientist environment, and he was only very briefly talking about one project that he had, which is called the Moral Choice Machine, and he covered this topic in a way that was actually, I think, intended to generate laughter from the audience, which I found not so appropriate, being the only ethicist in the room. Of course, I might be picky here, but what the system actually showed was it learned moral norms from text, from bodies of text, Wikipedia, internet, and so on and so forth. And then it was presented kind of in a fashion that said, of course, machines can learn morals. There's nothing too special about it. How do you learn morals? You just observe what is good or what is considered good and bad, and that's morality. I thought, oh, wait a minute. Might be a little bit too simple here. Of course, learning this from text could be possible, but is it really a good idea to do it like this? Considering that you, of course, learn the implicit or explicit biases that are also in this bodies of text or in the spoken word. And now the presentations, actually, and that was the funny part about it, that he was presenting as it like, of course, it's possible, but the video that he showed is there was a machine or a screen, and you could ask, is it ethical to lie to your girlfriend? And then the answer were always given in a kind of funny way. That depends. So on what does it depend? That's not really a nice and well-formulated moral argument. So, and there were like three or four of these examples. They were not that enlightening, and actually sometimes even wrong. So in a way, he gave visual proof that, well, his machine did not really work that well. We can do it better, but he was kind of overgeneralizing what it means to be a moral person, to have a moral understanding, or what actually kind of could even mean moral progress. And I thought, okay, maybe the way he goes about this, that we need to have some way of communicating that there's more complex things. It's not that easy. And still maybe technology can do something in this field that is worthwhile pursuing.
Why would they, so with this moral choice machine, it seemed to be taking in information. It's almost like an agglomeration of what it saw as people's opinions. Is that what it was doing essentially? Just collecting data from the internet.
Yep.
And then presenting it as that it thought would represent what the majority was or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think they also did, so they used a deep learning approach because that is what this science group does. And I think they also went further in trying to find the differences in moral norms based on ethnicity or nation and so on and so forth. Mm.
Good. And what was the purpose? Why would anyone want to have a machine that can do ethics in the first place?
That's in fact an interesting question. I think this is a question that's really at the forefront of what we need to answer. And I think there's some introductions of probably very good papers that kind of don't discuss that too much. They kind of jump the gun on this question. They say, okay, we have more autonomous machines. More autonomous machines can do things, well, more autonomously. If we let them loose, they better be ethical. So they need to think about ethics themselves. And the paper I was most impressed by, I'm sorry, I never can really pronounce the name right. She's called Professor Amy van Weinsberger, and she's actually now joined the University of Bonn in Germany. She was previously at the University of Technology in Delft. And together with Scott Robbins, she wrote a paper saying, what are the actual motivations to pursue machine ethics? And they kind of dismantled all those claims and looked at them more carefully. And in the end, they stated, okay, now the balls in the court of the machine ethicists actually prove that their pursuit is worthwhile, because we don't really see how worthwhile it can be. So there's always different ways of doing this, especially this question about more autonomous machines. They had a more complicated argument, but in summing it up, they basically said there's always the way of going for the safe thing, not for the thing that decides ethics on its own. And that should be possible. Otherwise, you need to prove that it's not possible. And I think there's, of course, an ongoing debate. I'm more inclined to say that what they say is right. But I was also not entirely convinced about some of their arguments. So I think I found something where I can add to.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So a lot of it seemed to be about, they thought that safety can be programmed, and that will do a lot of the job that we want it to do without having to teach it how to learn ethics or something like that. So how did you get from the moral choice machine to what you ended up talking about, which was formal ethics and inclusive moral deliberation?
I think this moral choice machine is one thing, but it's really also about a conception of what ethics means. So how should ethics enter technology? And of course, I'm not the only one to realize that there's different ways. So you cannot just make a machine think, but you could also design it such that it aligns with the morality or the ethical norms, the moral norms of society. And that would typically also be distinguished in scientific language, not so much, I think, in the typical everyday language, but I think it's worthwhile discussing and distinguishing these two. So in a way, I think ethic is not a problem that needs to be solved. And that's what technologists typically do. And I think it's their strength, and it's very good. I can really feel that. So I am still an engineer myself. I like to solve problems. But you have to make do with the fact that in ethics, there's sometimes not the solution, and it cannot be programmed. And from that, I think I was intrigued by people that, challenged this, to say the least, or they say, okay, ethics is something that can be solved, and to solve it, we need to formalize it, or we need to quantify it, and therefore we need to be able to program it, because there's one true solution. I think that's basically where I started to think about this.
Yeah. Good. So what are the key points that you arrived at after thinking about this issue?
Well, I think formal ethics as a scientific project is not harmful per se. As long as, and I think that's true also for every scientific project, as long as this proceeds with some humility on what it can actually achieve and do. And the very least, I think, that I would say is really an outcome of me considering all the work on formal ethics and machine ethics, is that they sometimes overclaim what they will do in the end. Could be harmful. Yeah, solve it, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes forgetting the role of the human in the equation. I found that most of the literature really, it's sad to say, but I think really most of the literature on formal ethics is severely lacking in terms of this kind of humility. And I think this is probably also true for many of the scientific things that we do. Of course, we want to sell our science. That's only natural. But in this field, I think it's it's paramount that we don't do this, because if we want to bring together disciplines, I as an ethicist must communicate what I can offer for product designers and computer scientists in a way that is not overselling what I can do and vice versa. So in this way, I think these sweeping generalizations of the nature of ethics and the potential impact, the suggested approaches, we need to move away from that. So
where's the alternative? So rather than trying to seek to solve ethics, what else could we do instead?
I think that, well, formal ethics can be a tool for solving those moral quandaries, but if we use this in a way that is really doing justice of, and that we're really aware of what it cannot do. That's I think the main point. Then we can integrate it in a way where society can even discuss whether we want it or not. So not just claim autonomous vehicles need a way to calculate ethics, so we need to do this, but actually first decide on what do we want those cars to do, and then reflect on what can we actually program. And there might be a mismatch. I think there will always be a mismatch. And that mismatch, of course, is something that we can criticize, but in the end, maybe we can also make an ethical evaluation as a society and say, but we want those autonomous cars so badly because we can prevent deaths. We cannot implement ethics as we really want to. So there will be this mismatch. We need to discuss this openly, and then we make a democratically legitimized decision that this is the way to proceed forward and not just have this go by chance because some computer science lab is not able to program it in the way that we actually want. And I think in this way, we can make peace with the autonomous systems that we build by actually having this, this moral debate about what we can also not achieve, but still want to have. I don't know if that became clear, but I think there's this gap that we can implement, and there's this with respect to the things that we would actually have. But as long as it's the best that we can do, we can also decide to just go forward with this, but there needs to be the discussion at least, and I don't see it yet, at least.
Right. So what do you think is missing?
In a way, I think is missing a way to balance power, even in this case. So I think there's powerful entities pursuing an agenda. And I'm not saying that this agenda is necessarily bad per se, but the way we pursue it, or the way these entities pursue it, is not something that is democratic in a sense. So people always use power to manipulate, and manipulation can also be seen as something that is not, so it usually has a negative connotation, but it could also be a positive connotation. It could be a little bit paternalistic. So we're actually aiming for the greater good. But I think since we're all individuals that have their own opinion, that can make up their minds, we need to take this seriously. And therefore I was thinking about, well, this must be something that somebody has thought about before. How would we actually go about this kind of moral deliberation in an inclusive way? So I think I found this guy to be Jürgen Habermas. He was outlining the ideal speech situation. And of course, I need to be humble myself. So I reframed this because I found that there was one way of putting this that might be a little bit more accessible. So I wasn't going to write a thesis about Jürgen Habermas, which can be a thing of its own, but I wanted to use his ideas because I found these very inspiring. So I dubbed one ideal situation that I thought could really sum it up to be inclusive moral deliberation. Have ideally everyone discussing what we want from autonomous systems, how that we can bring them to be ethical, whether we want to use formal ethics or not. So to be aligned to this example. And Jürgen Habermas' ideal speech situation is something that has a list of requirements, basically, and power is an integral part of this. So he demands that power asymmetries are neutralized such that the less powerful can have an equal say, can also participate, and in a fair and respected way, and then discuss this with the more powerful entities. And in the end, the decision will not be just based on who has the most power.
Right. So this seems like if we take this idea of having an equal say and having things to be inclusive, I mean, could we not apply that? Was that not similar to the moral choice machine? Was it not? Could we not make the solution of moral quandaries by just taking a vote and then having everyone say taken equally and added up?
Well, I think that's the thing where it goes deep into political theory, and I'm not convinced that democracy should work that way, because we have different social status, we have different kinds of educational levels. So the fair thing to do is really that those people that have yet to think about these things, give them some space and time to actually think about them, get them involved, and even really ask them to be involved, because they should also have their say, not just because some people are interested and some not. And that's basically the point that I made about formal ethics. So this is something that requires a lot of education, a lot of, well, knowledge about mathematics and logic and computer science even. Do we want only the people that are capable to decide on these things and to think about these things? Do we want them to be the only ones capable of actually thoroughly deliberate the moral implications of building autonomous systems? I don't think that this should be the case, because the systems that we're currently building, they involve everyone. They involve people that will struggle to earn their money on a day-to-day basis, and obviously we don't have the things in place right now to also engage them and involve them in these kind of moral deliberation. Probably they wouldn't say, okay, I'm not interested, I have other things to attend to, but that's ideally the situation that we should, well, given money, given time, given social security systems, that we should be able to afford.
Right, so the problem that you think with just the idea of aggregating people's opinions is that people have not had time, for instance, to think about it, or some people have not yet formed their opinion in an informed way. Is that the issue?
Yeah, in essence, yes. I think sometimes also that, well, having just the majority will decide, that of course does not really protect the minorities. They might have really, really good points. Just think of all the racism issues, feminism issues, and not minority might not be the right word here, but I think there's more to fairness than just doing what the majority wants. If that would be the case, I think the world at some point would be much, much less fair than if we make space for the underprivileged to also have their say. So we need more. So we need instruments to neutralize the power. And I think this is, if you have majority rule, this is basically something where you say we don't need this. But I'm convinced that we need this.
Right. So it's almost, you need like a reverse Cambridge Analytica or something, where instead of having a particular power which kind of influences the way people vote, or that was the aim, you need something the other way around, where there's a power to try and neutralize the power, or some mechanism by which we could neutralize power imbalances and influence.
Exactly. Yeah. I think the Cambridge Analytica scandal is a good example. Well, I picked it for the thesis. it's not very modest to say that it's a good example, but I think it is, really, because it shows voting power can be bought. You can manipulate people that don't have the time or don't have the awareness currently to critically reflect on things on who to vote for, who to elect. And you sneak in. So it's questionable how well that works. It needs to be said, I think. But I think it's safe to say that it does work somehow, and people are working on making this more effective. And if you sneak in ads that are micro-targeted on you in your Facebook newsfeed, I think that there's something to it, that this can really manipulate who you vote for, what you consider as in terms of good arguments, bad arguments. And since this is done in a way of ads, it is inherently coupled with the capitalist system underneath. So you can essentially vote by your voting power.
Yeah. And this whole mechanism is the opposite of an open and inclusive moral debate. Right, having targeted ads to specific people, maybe not even fully aware of what's going on. It's not exactly an open, inclusive debate where everyone's aware of what's going on and what information they're basing their choices on.
Yeah,
doesn't facilitate common understanding.
No.
So what does Foucault have to do with this? You bring in Foucault, don't you?
Yes, I do bring in Foucault, and I have to admit that mostly maybe because I'm fascinated with the French post-structuralist movement. I think there's lots of ideas. Sometimes they are maybe formulated in a sketchy way. Sometimes people have accused Foucault, especially of pseudo-philosophy. I think it's inspiring, and it brings new ideas. And if philosophy is good for that, then what else is good for? So I think I wouldn't really accuse him of pseudo philosophy. But of course, I think he's incredibly hard to read. And I cannot say that I'm a scholar, Foucault scholar. I've mostly read about him and very little from himself. But the one thing that I got is that he was interested in power all the way. And he criticized Jeremy Bentham's Panopticum idea because he was analyzing what power is about here. And in the end, I think in his later interviews, he came to the conclusion that power is always present. So I'm quoting him now. Power is always present. I mean, the relationships in which one wishes to direct the behavior of another. And in a sense, well, that might sound cynical, but in a business and in a larger political statement, I think it's a good way to assume that things are run this way. So you cannot, as Habermas wishes to do, you cannot eradicate power from the equation of inclusive moral debate altogether. So one thing that we can do is, well, analyze and depict where power comes into play, in which facets. And I think this is one thing that I try to bring to the table in actually being more practical about this ideal speech situation. What is the actual, what are the entities, what are the protagonists that have power here, and how can that be seen? And ideally, I didn't really answer this question, what can we do about this? So I think, but this is the first step, identifying where power lies.
Right. So in summary then, what is inclusive moral deliberation in the ideal?
So I think inclusive moral deliberation to me is a rather fragile way to go about trying to decide upon moral questions that can be based on actual open debate. But not only in this event of debate where you think of round table, people come together and then decide on something, but also you can think about this as a decentralized deliberative process. As we live in a world where the market has a lot to say on how things evolve, this is also one of the processes that is involved in also deciding about moral matters. Or maybe it doesn't decide on this, but as a matter of fact, we could turn out to have autonomous cars in the next 5 years. And I'm not making any predictions here that might not be sound, but some things on these definitely will be autonomous. But well, no real deliberation has taken place, but in some they are making facts that of course sometimes people accept, sometimes are challenged. So this is also part of the deliberative process, trying out things. I would wish more for going back to the debate, but I still see that we have this decentralized way of deciding things. And I think that's also good, because it has many, many ways of letting people voice their opinions, also by their behavior, also by their deeds. And therefore, I think this inclusive moral deliberation also takes account of that. And when trying to realize this Habermasian list of requirements for the idea of speech situation in such an inclusive moral deliberation, we need to have these power asymmetries firmly in sight and also develop ways to counter them. And therefore, I tried not to use the same term as Habermas, but like to connect this with the Foucauldian idea of power and hopefully have something that is a new idea that would lead somewhere.
Okay, so let's link this together then. So what are the implications then for formal ethics?
So, well, in the dissertation, I've tried to structure my argument along the requirements that Habermas listed for his idea of speech situation. So maybe to recap, so everybody should be able to take part and have an equal possibility to contribute, are also capable of empathizing with each other. I think we didn't talk about this yet. And the last two points are basically tackling the power issue. So everybody should be able to engage with each other or should engage with each other in a transparent, non-strategic and non-deceptive way, which kind of also implies, but it's given as an extra point by Habermas, that the power differences should be neutralized. And I structured the thesis along this. So with respect to the first two, I've argued that formal ethics has the potential to raise technical as well as social barriers to participation in moral deliberation. And I think I said this already. It's quite simply because you need to be educated in those formalisms. So they are the barrier themselves. That could be also turned around. So I discussed this because if you're familiar with ethics, that might not be something that is formalized in terms of equations necessarily, but you also have some moral authority, or at least you're attributed some moral authority that could, of course, also be used as an entry barrier or as an instrument of power. So I think it needs to be seen from both sides. That's why I hinted at science and humanities as well should be humble about what they can do and how they pronounce their goals and also their achievements. So ideally, moral deliberation is not something that can be outsourced to experts. That's I think what I say here. And formal ethics is something that is for experts, at least for the time being. So that's dangerous in a sense.
It's similar to when people use jargon when they're doing, say, scientific explanations or any explanations, and they're using lots and lots of language that is not accessible to other people, and it excludes them because they can't understand what's being said. Is this similar?
Yeah, it's pretty similar. I have to be honest, I'm partial to this fault myself. So you always have to question, so whom do you want to reach? And whom should you reach, maybe even? What effort should you take to reach somebody? Because that the thing that you found out and that you thought you found out is something that some people should know. And and then frame it in a way that is accessible, that makes people think about this. And of course, it's difficult. And sometimes people say, oh, it's not possible. Quantum physics is not accessible. But I think as science progresses in the different fields, there's remarkable people that have achieved to actually break it down. And maybe it's not the task of everybody, but there needs to be someone at least who tries to do this, like Stephen Hawking or whatnot. So these incredibly clever people that have found a way to talk about very difficult things in a very understandable way. I admire that to a large degree. Yeah, and when thinking about these requirements, I think also that the point of being capable to empathize that struck me as something that I could never really tackle. So why can we not go about this in a logical way? And I think this is even, that's maybe the engineer, where the engineer comes out of me, is most present. Maybe that's one of the larger fault lines of formal ethics, because I think empathy has next to nothing to do with how they pursue ethics, but that's not yet been decided. So there's more theories where empathy have a large role, and we wouldn't really want to exclude them, would we? So not everything is about rigor and logic, but empathy is something that when we can never evade the situation where we have to eventually decide things for other people as well at some point, without empathy, I think it will not go that well. And I just recently encountered a situation where I was not very empathetic with a student of mine. I think we should learn from that it's really a relevant thing in deciding what is the most moral way.
Right. So in the previous iterations, they might be trying to formalize ethics in a very rule-based way. And so it's very logic-y and goes through a very rigid procedure, which is rigorous and clear. But then you're saying, well, what's missing, or at least a key part of what's missing, is this idea of empathy and sympathy for other people, which can help us shape what we think the ethical thing to do is. And that's something that formal ethics and programming it into a machine hasn't yet taken into account.
Yeah, and I think the other ways of going about formalizing ethics, which of course needs some discussion whether that still counts for formal ethics, but I think in a way it does. So doing what this moral choice machine does, it's not a good substitute for empathizing if you just take what people have written down, what people do, what can be recorded. This is a good qualification, I think, because it always, if you work with data, you also have to question what can you actually record in data and what can you not record. And I think the empathy is not something that you can nicely record. And at least in very few instances, it will manifest in the data. And then that's just input and output, so the situation and the moral, seemingly moral solution. But so what I'm talking about is you train a neural network or something like this based on data, based on text bodies. Where's the empathy in that? It isn't really. So even if that would work well, those systems would tackle issues that concern humans and those humans that are then affected by this, they might not be given the time and the space to empathize, because ideally we need to question, what do we actually want to do with these systems? Do we want them to tell us what is right and wrong? So to kind of speed things up, and speeding things up is not good for developing empathy, I think. So that cannot be the goal, let's say, in a way.
That's interesting. I mean, maybe speeding things up might be useful when you're in a hurry. Would that be a fair thing to say? Or do you think essentially there's just a danger of over-reliance on something telling you the moral answer, and then you don't develop your own empathy and capacities?
Yeah, essentially, I think this is the danger. But well, of course, we need to be fair and say, okay, there's things that are, there is really a sense of hurry. And I think the example of autonomous cars fits in right very well. So if I make a decision when I drive the car, I also don't have time to empathize. Maybe I have to train this. Maybe I'm too pessimistic about this. I do empathize. I do think about how other people engage with me in traffic, and I update my routine and my ways to approach this based on the lessons I learned, or I thought I learned about empathizing when empathizing. So I'm more cautious. I wait. Maybe I give a hand sign, and these things, of course, they are not necessary anymore. Maybe with autonomous cars, that might not be necessarily a bad thing. But with autonomous cars, we definitely run into situations that we also have now, split second decisions. So, is empathy really something that is necessary there? That's a good question. And I think I've not really answered this. So it's still an open thing. I think it might turn out that, after all, we need formal ethics to decide on the issues there. So the best answer then I have is that we need to go back and really talk about what formal ethics can do and how this aligns with what we would want it to do. And if there's a mismatch, transparently communicating this and decide an inclusive moral debate that we really want to pursue this. What I would say then is it might not turn out to be really an autonomous car doing ethics. We still do the ethics of deciding how we want to program it. And in the end, it would boil down to something that we could also formulate in terms of rules. So I'm not convinced that what we eventually do in these situations is that we endow cars with a sense of ethics. So I think the empathizing needs to be done first and offline and not in the system. So in a sense, what I'm saying is, okay, formal ethics might not need empathy, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the car doesn't do ethics. We do ethics before. That's maybe my main point here.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So what is the difference between moral and technological progress, and what's the significance of moral understanding here?
So I think when thinking about this, I was anticipating a particular objection to challenging formalisms and ethic, which would go as this. So we've made a great deal of progress as a society based on scientific and technological formalisms. Why should this be any different in ethics? Can we not just tolerate a lack of inclusion and some power symmetries to promote progress? So is it not for the greater good? And I think, well, it's a good point to discuss, but I think this argument could be rather seen as similar to tolerating some social inequality to promote economic growth, which could ideally improve the life for everyone. So it's fair to raise this concern, and that made me think about what progress could mean in the different fields here. Because I think the matter lies radically different when we consider moral progress as opposed to scientific or technological process. I believe that an increased moral understanding is something there where I can talk about what this means. It's not my framing, but it's due to Alison Hills. But if we can take this as an intuitive understanding, what would mean moral understanding now, I think this is something that really needs to permeate society to actually achieve moral progress. Whereas in technological understanding, it's safe to delegate this to experts, because it's not necessary to understand technology in its entirety to actually reap the benefits of that so much as in morality.
Yeah, we don't have to understand how it works as when it comes to technological stuff. As long as it works and we can use it, we're satisfied. But you think morality is different. It's not enough to just know the answer.
Exactly, yeah. So I was looking for different definitions of moral progress, but I think they were kind of always very much in the same line, as at least in terms of the detail that I was considering in my thesis. So Moody Adams had a notion of moral progress that I found most striking here. And she said, moral progress in belief involves deepening our grasp of existing moral concepts, while moral progress in practices involves realizing deepened moral understandings in behavior or social institutions. So it's really something about that we need to practice. It's not just knowing. It's about practicing, and that aligned very well with what Alison Hills is saying about moral understanding, which she takes as the ability to put moral knowledge into practice. So being able to argue and elaborate, and that would really strongly facilitate moral progress in this regard. If we increase the ability overall in society to actually be able to engage in moral debate, basically.
Yeah, that's good. I like this idea. Before you were saying essentially we do ethics first and then we could implement it. What if someone argued the other way around? What if someone said, well, can't we do some machine ethics, formalize ethics, and construct moral advisors? So this time they do the ethics first, but we don't leave humans out of the equation. We can still then decide afterwards whether or not to follow what the advisor says. Would that work?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think that it works. And for that regard, I think it's necessary to reconnect this to the ideas of power and yeah, also questioning the underlying intentions of those in power that would build these things. So I found that the core arguments for these moral advisors typically lie with that is often proclaimed that humans are insufficient as information processors. They cannot consider everything. They have a gut feeling, and then they make some random decision which is not well thought out. The other thing that these moral advisors are typically concerned, I think we touched upon this already, is the issue of time. So why do we want these things? To speed things up, to be more efficient in making our moral decisions. And that's also something that I discussed in the project work. I don't think efficiency and moral deliberation really go well together. Being, for example, for the matter of empathizing, but also other reasons. So I think this whole idea of designing artificial moral advisors really caters to the notion of what I would really then call an attempt to increase moral efficiency. And this, apart from empathizing, moral understanding will not be promoted by this, because that needs to be practiced. If we do the practicing, if we let other things do the practicing for us, then how would this improve our moral understanding?
In that case, well, the final thing that I'd like to ask you about is, what would you conceive of as useful formal approaches to ethics, given that you've ruled out these particular ones?
Well, I think, of course, this would stretch the idea of being formal quite a bit. But if we could strip approaches to formalize ethical evaluations from trying to increase this efficiency, but rather use them as a way of translating between different disciplines. So me as an ethicist, I can talk things and I write things which I think, okay, this is natural language, everybody can read this. But well, I thought about this a lot more than some other technologists and vice versa. So my ideas as an ethicist need to be translated to technologists, and the technologist's idea need to be translated to me. And that's only these two disciplines that I have in mind now. But of course, there could be way more disciplines. And well, if we want to speed things up, then sometimes it might be necessary not to write 20 pages as a paper and then say, okay, go read this. And after 2 days or so, we'll have a talk again. But maybe we could try and visualize the connections, who's affected, linkages, in a way that formalizes how we think about ethical evaluations. But we should keep in mind that every time we introduce a formalism, there will also limitations. For example, in deciding what is ethically relevant, there's this nice thing which is called an ethics canvas, which is kind of the business model canvas adapted to ethics. If you do this, so you really have at a glance what could be necessary and what could be relevant in terms of ethical implications. That's nice. If you know that there might be also more to it, but it's also a very good vehicle, I think, to have a very interdisciplinary discussion about ethical aspects. So visualizations would be one thing that could also go as a kind of formalization. Of course, but then we need something like, okay, this affects this. This is the value that is associated with this. I think I consider this as a formal way of going about this. And it would really mean that we are serious about this argument that moral expertise, as I said already, is also establishing a barrier. And I'm the least to want to exclude technologists and having these ethical debates. So I think they are perfectly in place, and they even have a responsibility to have to participate in these debates, because they will be the one, at least until now, that primarily design the technology that might be used in morally salient situations. Well, there's one more thing. Maybe this moral advisor idea should not be dismissed altogether. I could also imagine, and I think there's also training programs to teach ethics like this, which is supported by technology, where you could design them in a different way. And there's ideas that that we use them as a kind of question and answer game. So they call it a Socratic assistant that offers questions to promote personal reflection. And I think that could be very helpful. But of course, whenever we design systems with an underlying logic, with an underlying framework, we always need to be very open about what we are not discussing there. So if we really think about a widespread adoption of such advisors, I always, and that's what I also wrote in the first thesis, I kind of fear that we might skew our understanding of morality towards a particular normative theory and exclude something too soon. So there's this danger, but maybe this danger can be averted if we don't make Socratic assistants as moral advisors a mandatory use case, because it's not about efficiency now, it's about being better. And then, of course, we start questioning. So I think this is not too troublesome then.
Right. So the worry there was, well, I suppose the same worry was also with Socrates, in that you might think that he had an idea in his mind that he was nudging people towards with his probing questions. And so you might think, well, if we're going to design a Socratic assistant, there might be something similar going on where maybe the designer is nudging people towards a particular answer rather than merely including questions to follow where the individual is going to go.
Interesting. Yeah, I think the main issue is not so much that there is some nudging, because if we both talk about things, I'm also nudging you to, of course, be very convinced that formal approaches to ethics is is something that is dangerous, because I have a particular view about this. But if I would now go about and program an advisor that promotes this idea a millionfold, because it's a system that can be replicated as a piece of software, I think then there's an issue of power again that needs to be taken seriously. People have thought about this. Those Socratic assistants kind of learn the moral norms of each individual and then adapt to them. That is, of course, all fair to consider this. But I think the general issue on power and those manufacturers that those manufacturers of those advisors could exert is still present and cannot be easily amended and alleviated.
Yeah. Good. Was there one final thing that you have, or?
Well, I think in terms of what I said in the dissertation, that covered a lot of ground. Well, what I wanted to say is I'm very happy that you supervised both of my theses. It was a pleasure working with you. I've not said this now, but I think at least the idea of a moral understanding and pushing me towards this and having a look at that was your idea. So thank you for that. I found this very enlightening.
Thank you for mentioning it. The pleasure was mine. I enjoyed every minute of it. It was good.
And I think this is also something that that could go on this podcast, because I really enjoyed attending the program at the University of Leeds. I was kind of... I had my reservations. I really wanted to have that MA, but I wasn't so sure whether it would work that well online. And it worked remarkably well. There were very, very good discussions on the forums. And I also found it remarkably enlightening how all those essays were graded. So I learned a lot. And thanks for that to the entire team. Wow.
That's lovely feedback to hear. So thank you very much for saying so. and be a part of part of the course is the students being able to interact. And so, you know, you get out what you bring to it in that sense as well. So it's definitely a lot to do with you and the other students contributing so much. Good. So yeah, thanks very much for being here. Thanks for taking the time to come on the Idea Pod. And pleasure. Yeah, best of luck with your research hub. And yeah, thanks again.
Thank you.
The Idea Pod is produced by the Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied Centre at the University of Leeds. Find out more at ahc.leeds.ac.uk/ethics. Music composed and conducted by Josh Armitage.